In my workplace at the time, I was developing a pump that was to be used in the trailer parks after Hurricane Katrina. And as part of the investment in the product, some of the distributors in the States wanted to talk to the designer and have him present. So this is my journey. I was going to go over to the States with a sales and marketing person and meet these people. And as we set off along the road, it became a much more scientific journey. The tarmacadam of the road and the journey of the oil from the centre of the earth coming up and creating this carpet on the road for me to travel on. This deep oil mineral that it's actually the expression of this blood of the earth that we're using. And the white lines in the centre of the road were far whiter. And I kind of knew at this point that I was there again, that I'd been brought to this place, and like a very special invitation to do some great thing, like a warrior. When we got to Dublin, everything was set. I could just start being in the role I was meant to be in. So I took off my socks and shoes and rolled up my jeans, and I just walked out into the night, just wearing a t-shirt. The night was freezing, you know, everything was crystal and all the lights were shining off all of the cars. It was like a silent orchestra of all these muted engines, all fueled by this oil that was bringing us all together. And I walked around in the airport car park, placing so many pebbles in front of the tire of the same number of cars and setting everything up so that there would be like a mathematical alignment for what was to happen. When we got on the plane and the plane was taking off, then I knew this is it. The whole journey was just like a wonderful return across the oceans from all of the clouds formed very specific shapes. I could see that there was things happening in the oceans.
I hadn't slept now for a few nights.
I had about $400 American.
In God We Trust was written on every American.
So I got rid of the money, flushed it down the toilet.
We got into Atlanta.
In the airport.
I was moving around,
racing through corridors,
making very close contact with
just
people.
Just commenting how it was amazing that there was no blood on their boots. And we had to be sent back on the next flight. I ended up back in the local mental hospital, which was St. Sennans at the time.
Closing up door. Oh, no, no, no. Everyone will be closing the door.
As a young boy, I just remember being like full of adventure and excitement. Everything was a thrill for me. I could see fairies every place. I used to bring my parents out to the trees and point out the fairies to them. We lived just outside the village of Adamstown in this wonderful, small, asbestos prefab house. It was one of the first of the Irish ideal homes. It had been won in a fashion competition in the Sunday Press, so it was one of the first homes displaying tintawn carpets and scarif chipboard and an all-electric immersion heater and a flush toilet. It was perfect. As children, we basically ran the farm. We fed the cattle, we cleaned out the sheds. As we got older, we milked the cows. We had two cows and we'd milk them in the morning. That was all considered to be part of childhood living. There was three families in the area. There was lots of games and staged battles. And the big thing was on a Saturday to get our work done really early. And we'd head off for an adventure, maybe six or eight kids together. And we'd just spend the day wandering through fields, like jumping over streams or ditches or whatever. For me, it was just a very carefree, enjoyable existence. I was always very driven, even as a kid, you know, I had a huge amount of energy. So I do remember at Christmases, sticking my head in the window to see people watching West Side Story or whatever on the TV. And I would be more excited just making things out in the shed, some kind of toys or things that we'd be playing with. I saved up strawberry picking money when I was 9. I wanted to buy a corgi. When I got her, there was a small kennel that my dad built under the diesel tank, and we put a plywood door on it, and she was to be kept safe in there. And this was drilled into me that I was responsible for this dog and she must never have pups unless they're purebred pups. I came out one morning, she was in heat and there was a big hole in the middle of the plywood and she was running around the yard. I just locked her up again and hoped and prayed, and I was very religious, and I prayed and prayed and prayed that she wouldn't be in pup. About 60 days later, anyway, she had six beautiful puppies, all unmistakably mongrel. I was told very definitely by my parents that pups must go and I was responsible. And I didn't disagree with it or argue with it or anything. I knew that's the way it happens. So I went out to the trees at the back of the house and brought the bucket, filled it with water, and tried to drown the pups. It was a wet night and I had my tiny little child's torch. I was holding this and watching them. I was thinking maybe if I could squeeze their necks or break their necks while I was drowning them, it could speed things up. And I was bawling my eyes out, really distraught. Then I laid them all out on the grass and some of them were twitching. And I remember thinking then, if some of them are alive now, because they were moving, there were small movements, I'm just going to keep them and I don't care what happens, but I'll look after them. After a few minutes, the movement stopped. Then I buried them. At the back of the trees, I buried them there and the job was done. I came back into the house and was never asked about it. It was just expected that, yeah, that should be sorted. That night, it really separated me from all the joy of my childhood up to then. You know, a neighbour used to say when I was a kid, he's going to be a millionaire by the time he's 20. Because I was breeding my dogs and I'd be buying heifers. I sold my first heifer in the mart when I was only 11. I had this determined attitude about everything and that you could achieve whatever you set your mind to and it could be done and all that. Then that will left me. And when it changed, my mind was a stranger. It was lost to me. And it was quite sudden. In the morning, I couldn't get out of bed. Everything was a struggle. Speaking to people, going up to school, doing homework. I just didn't understand who I was or what I was. This new state I was in was sinking everything very quickly and with huge density, like just pulling everything down. So at nighttime, I would get to bed as early as I could and just lie in bed dreaming of a huge drill coming down through my head, tearing my brains out. I would kind of delight in these gory thoughts of ending my life, of it being over. The only thing that had some relief was that escape of the bed at nighttime. In college, years later, I could spend 16, 17 hours a day sleeping. And I'd get up in the middle of the night when there was nobody on the streets in Limerick, just me and the stray dogs, taking scraps out of bins. These states or these depressions, they would go on for months. My escape route began really when I was probably 14 or 15 and started drinking. I'd work with a local builder and every weekend I'd get a 5-9 bottle of brandy. That lasted all through my leave insert cycle, kind of fifth year and sixth year in school. Then when I went to college, large amounts of spirits was still a big thing for me, you know, and I had the freedom to do it. It was a great escape. Then I discovered cannabis or cannabis-derived substances. The first time I smoked dope, that weekend, I only left the flat a couple of times. And it's like I had discovered a whole new world. I started arranging things within the flat and doing things and really kind of going into something inside myself that I hadn't touched before. way of connecting with my surroundings. And I'm not a laughing kind of guy, you know. I never have been a smiley kind of laughing person. But that was one of the true releases I got smoking dope. The ability to laugh. The other thing was, I discovered I could do amazing stuff when I was stoned. Essays, engineering projects that would get top of the class. And I was getting top of the class. Until one final exam that I did stoned. But I did find within myself a creativity that I didn't know existed. And I thought it was only unlocked with cannabis. I didn't realize that I could access it in any other way. I went to London and had a really very, very crazy time. I was getting higher and higher all the time, like really felt that I could do anything I wanted. You know, I had no fear, there was no danger. There was a girl that I very much wanted to be with, and she didn't need me at that time. That almost ended in tragedy. The only thing that saved that tragedy was the interruption of another person. So after that night, I fled to Amsterdam. In Amsterdam, I was sleeping on the street in the beginning and eventually got into a squat and started to get some night work in the Seneste Hotel. Saturday night, it was the 10th of August, and I sat in Dam Square and I'd started doing sketches in a diary I had. These were very simple stick drawings, but I'd have the name and the date and the place. I wouldn't get paid for a month, so I had no money and I was living mostly from the plates where I was washing up in the Seneste, whatever was left over, very good food coming in, and I never had a problem eating like that. I got very bad leg ulcers. I went to a doctor in this basement practice, and without prompting, they offered me money. They handed me money to go get a prescription. I was thrilled. I was thinking, money, I can now buy a bit of dope, you know. And I was walking down into the lights plane and I said I'd enough left maybe for a cup of coffee, about 50p. And I could just see phones, every place, phones and phones in the lobbies of hotels. They just were jumping out like they were animated. I saw kind of a message and had to respond to a message. I said, I've got to connect and ring someone. So I got to a phone box and I had so little money, it went down so quickly that it started beeping almost immediately when I rang home. It was answered by my aunt. She could hear it beeping already. She just said, where are you? And I said, Amsterdam. She just had to say very quick, your father is dead. When I was going through some of the stuff that I'd brought back from Amsterdam, I came across these two pages, Dam Square, August 10th. So that's how I know it was exactly at the time that my father died, that I did a drawing of him and my mother in a swing boat titled Mum and Dad Having Fun, or Mum and Dad at the Carnival, actually it was. Then on the next page, I had the two of them just standing side by side, holding hands, saying Mum and Dad. That diary was a great source of comfort and kind of solace to me months later, just to realize there was some big connection in the world, that at the moment when he was dying and leaving this earth, I was somehow connected to him through this drawing, through what I was doing. And that no matter how much he might have refused to accept or forgive me for who I was or what was going on at the time, we were connected in this way, through the universe, through God, through a pencil drawing, through whatever. But it was for real, it was dated, it was timed, and couldn't be refuted. After his death, more and more connections seemed to become evident in my life, in my daily life, like things that were happening, people I was meeting. It was actually becoming unusual to meet somebody where there was no connection, where it's like this connectivity had opened up and was never closed again. When I began to notice these connections, I was almost electrified, you know, in my life. I was doing things all the time. I was moving. I needed to sleep very little. Every day was a delight. Many of my days involved being down by the river, fishing with my barbless hooks, coming in missing exams and not even making excuses to the lecturers. You know, it didn't really seem to be so relevant. I started to collect and take magic mushrooms, pursuing some kind of enlightenment. I was just coming up with all kinds of theories about nature. I left my shoes and discarded nearly everything I had. Just walked, and I could see the trees signalling me and showing me the door. Houses looked at me, like the windows of the front door with the eyes and the mouth, and the same with the cars. I might have to say something three times, or tip myself with the tip of my cigarette three times, three little burns on the back of my hand, just to cancel out this evil. I was filling notebooks with all the revelations. So I covered my body in black and red gloss paint, and I was rubbing all kinds of things into my body and my hair, like earth and tar and anything I could find on the road. I was the person chosen, that I was going to be the kind of acupuncture point that would heal the world. And at this stage, I hadn't slept for many, many, many days. And I kept walking up into the mountain, chanting continuously, so ecstatic with the world, and yet crying. And the revelations were coming at a never-increasing speed. Everything was arriving at me at once. Eventually, I came down off the mountain in Dungarvan and stuck my bare feet into the fire. People pulled me from the fire and they got me in the car. And I didn't know where I was being driven, but I had a police escort to wherever I was going. Surely they were bringing me either back to Adamstown or to someplace far greater. And they drove me to Waterford. And I don't even know if I knew it was a mental hospital, but so I just collapsed in the car and refused to move. So they had to carry me in. And even in the hospital, I felt, yes, this is where they bring us. This is the place. This is heaven. And this is where we're brought, all us souls that have made it true. And I could relate to each and every one of the other people in the hospital. And we could discuss things at an incredible depth. And we were all on the same wavelength. And we were treated like kings and given plates of food and given the brew of the time, but it was like a really sweet syrup. And I would drink as much of it as they wanted to give me. I thought it was the nectar of the gods they were giving me. And no matter how much of these very high doses of sedative I was given, I was still completely wired. I was put into the lockup ward, and it was a strange, crazy place. And it was just one huge room with chairs all around. It was mostly old men, the incurables, I suppose. And some people smoking cigarettes and unable, because they were strapped into chairs, unable to do anything but keep smoking the non-tip cigarette until it got right down to their lip and literally only millimetres left. And they would have it timed so well that just as it would burn into their lip, they'd just blow it out onto the ground in front of them. I'd been in hospital a long time, and the problem was that I wasn't going down with the medication. I just wasn't going down. A lot of blame was being put on the amount of drugs I'd taken, and that I'd put myself kind of out of reach of the sedatives and antipsychotics. You know, I was just completely out of reach for them. But eventually, over time, they did kick in. But that was after months of treatment. And when they kicked in, the really frightening part for me was my face went into spasm. There's a medical term for it, but it's where literally the lower jaw locks off to the left and the whole face locks up completely. And at that point, I was in their hands. You know, they could work with me then and they could keep me down. And then I went down. And when I went down, I went completely down. All of that incredible magical stuff and revelations and knowledge of the art, it was completely gone. There wasn't really much of a memory of it or a feeling of it or a trace of it. And just the really deep depression took over. Then once I was malleable, let's say, well, I was told I was a drug addict, you know, so we had to work with this drug addiction. And it was only from a doctor in Limerick when I went back to college who I explained about being a drug addict, and when I give up drugs, that's fine, I can come off this lithium, you know. And he looked at me and he said, has nobody explained to you? He said, you've been diagnosed with manic depression, what we call bipolar illness nowadays. And I said, you mean I've given up smoking dope, I've given up drinking, I've given up, and now I have a mental illness? And for me, there was really nothing cool about having a mental illness. I didn't really mind being a drug addict. You know, there was some cool factor there maybe, but having a mental illness, that really wasn't what I had signed up for. And he said, yeah, you've got manic depression. I said, so I take lithium and I never get sick again. Is that how it works? And he said, yeah, that, pretty much, he said, yeah. Several people had colluded around this, convincing me about being a drug addict. My mother would have been the one who gave me the strongest message and who, even in later years, would have refused to acknowledge the mental health component. She had a bracelet made for me, actually, the first time I came out of a hospital with "I am a drug addict" written on the bracelet. And I was very obedient. I didn't realise that she might not be telling me the whole truth. I ripped off that bloody silver bracelet and flung it into the Shannon. And I went off to buy a half ounce of dope. And I reckoned, if I'm going to be stuck on lithium for the rest of my life, I'm going to bloody well enjoy a smoke. I'm getting rolled on my Acapulco gold. Now, I didn't realise, of course, that smoking dope might not have been the best thing for somebody with manic depression. And there was nobody there to point that out to me either, for a couple of years, in fact. For me, of course, it was a great disappointment that my family couldn't openly discuss or accept the idea of mental illness. It was only when I was 28 years of age, like years after this, I was to discover that not only was there mental illness in the family, but it had formed a precedent of Irish law where a man who was unreasonable of mind, that was my grandfather, was about to give away all the lands and that where his family lived and home, the ideal home that had been won in the competition. And for years, I was led to believe that I was this shock to the whole family. And all this information was out there and nobody had mentioned it. Even in recent years, if I have an episode and I'm getting a sick cert signed, most doctors will not want to put down manic depression. And I often insist that they write manic depression or bipolar disorder. And often they say, well, let's put down anxiety or let's put... And I'm thinking, if we're going to let's put down shit on forms, it's because we can't fucking handle what's happening in somebody's life when they're unwell. And I think, actually, the biggest danger in today's society is for well-off, middle-class people who have mental illness, because they can go to a doctor and the doctor, to preserve their standing in the community, can try to collude with them into some false diagnosis or pretending something so that we don't have to address the nasty facts. In Limerick, my psychiatrist advised that I don't go to India, particularly when my chief interest in India was really cheap dope, you know, and a free kind of a lifestyle. And instead, he suggested that I should go to a European country. And he said Germany would be a very good choice. And I went to Germany and ended up in Nuremberg, down near Dutzendijk, in the Messestadion and Hitler's marching ground. And it all became very, very relevant, where I was living, what I was doing, my role in the whole exoneration of the German race and bringing their souls into freedom. And the upshot of that was leaving my job, being told by the guy driving the van that day, isn't this a van you'd like to drive? And taking that as a signal, going down in the middle of the night, the keys of the van were in the ignition. It was like the whole thing was prepared for me. And I took the van and went what would be considered as joyriding through Nuremberg. But in fact, for me, it was a whole significant route through the city. And then getting chased by the police cars, going down tram lines, meeting trams, reversing back, trying to get to the main train station to escape on a train. And I knew that was a sacred place because they sold Sweet Afton, my favourite cigarette. Just getting to the station, they surrounded me, the police, and so I rammed a police car, and the next thing I felt was a gun to my head, and I could smell the steel. And they kicked me to pieces when they got me, because I escaped them going down one-way streets and stuff like that. And that involved, I would say, my most pleasurable stay ever in a mental hospital, which was in Ansbach in Germany. out in the woodlands with individual housing. You know, we had these kind of family type arrangements with just patients in the houses, not nurses, you know, once you got out of the main building. I've never been medicated for depression because depression has never been the thing that worries people about me. So I've always come around depression, and it's usually time, just time, because now I guess other things that you do, like in changing your behaviors, like not allowing yourself to sleep for 16 hours a day and making yourself function on that, do improve things and bring you back to normal living. But I don't see any short circuits in depression. And even now, when a depression sets in, I just surrender. I just say, okay, this is going to be months. I just make a routine and I just go with the routine. Very few people would know I'm depressed. My wife can guess sometimes, not always. One or two other people. Depression gets buried very deeply, especially in people who are very used to being depressed. You can do most normal things. There might be the occasional vicious outburst or an apparent tiredness or something. But generally, people you work with, people in your community, friends, relatives, they don't know. You can wear that mask for as long as you need to in those moments you're with people. And that's why I think it's often no shock when, like, suddenly somebody's gone and people were saying, you know, there was no signal, there was no signs. But sometimes I will say when a depression is over, I'll never speak about a depression during it. That was a really lousy springtime. While everybody else was really enjoying the spring, I would have been dreaming of suicide plans. Because for me, to have an escape planned is part of my escape from depression. And I wouldn't have to consider other ways of doing it. And I would agree with myself to hold off. And it was only twice in my life when I would have actually really planned and attempted to execute a suicide. And in both instances, I was interrupted in the most uncanny circumstances. When I got back from Nuremberg, a good friend of mine had offered to let me stay at his house in Limerick. So I made my way to Limerick and moved into the house. I met one of the guys in the house who I hadn't really known before, and my sister had known his brother quite well in college in Dublin, and that brother had committed suicide. And it wasn't spoken about in the house, but I knew of it when I heard who it was and the name and stuff. And I remember when I met him and hearing this story, realising that it's not coincidence. There is no coincidence. There's just connections. And it's just a matter of being able to see the connections or not see the connections. You know, and once you see the connections, everything is connected. So it's simple enough. The guys go out at 9. They go to college for the day. They were all students still. And I was sitting there literally recuperating and really never leaving the house except to go for my weekly visit to the psychiatrist. And I would do the most mundane of household tasks, but every task was enormous and I would have to think about it. It seemed like for hours before I would do something, or even the washing up, the drudgery of washing 4 cups or 4 plates. And it had that sense that this was never, ever going to change. I saw no reason to live this kind of a life. So I set about making plans, but the difference between this and other times making plans, which I'd done a number of times in the past, was here, I really had a sense of purpose. I had a time frame in my mind, nearly, when this had to be done. I could use the garage in the house, and that way I wouldn't be seen doing anything and nobody could help me. So that was it. I found a way in the garage. I knew everything was right. I had had a couple of kind of trial runs. So it was done, and the relief was amazing. And I was actually almost in good form. I could enjoy a few nights with these friends where I was living because my mind was relieved. You know, I was actually in that free space now where I was just waiting for the boat to leave. The morning arrived, everybody left. I did my, I can't remember what exactly I did, maybe tidying up the house or something, but it took maybe half an hour or 40 minutes or something just to do whatever I was doing. And I went into the garage, got everything prepared, and I wasn't leaving anything. I didn't want messages, notes, explanations. I just wanted out. And the moment had arrived. And the garage door burst open. And I tried to look like I had some purpose in there in the garage, completely flustered. was the housemate whose brother had committed suicide who was there with his bicycle. So in the following days, I went out along the railway lines and looking for obscure places that would be away from... And even the dump was no use. There was loads of people foraging out around the dump and that it had to be someplace more secluded. And yet I didn't have transport as such to get places. And over the course of those days, and that was really just a number of days, things changed. And again, once the change came, the change was immediate, back into a positive sense about the world. I remember making the decision after the second time that, okay, in future, I can make my plans, but I will just hold off and hold off and hold off. But I won't prevent myself from making the plans. And that making of plans has become for me so far a release valve. So when I get those suicidal tendencies and depression, I can say, okay, well, here is how it would happen. And here's the plan that I would use. Now, let's get on with the hard work of waiting this out. And sometimes that wait just seems too long. You know, sometimes it goes on for 10 weeks, goes on for maybe nearly 3 months, and you're just getting worn down more and more. And for me, if I wait long enough, so far, it's always changed. And that's the danger point. Because when it changes, it's normally not a gradual swing. It's a really rapid swing into energy mode. Loads of thoughts, loads of activity. And that's what's considered like a danger to society, a danger to myself. And that's what people want to stop. That's why I say I've never been asked by psychiatrists about the dangers of my depression. It was never even discussed with me, you know, because it's the dangers of my mania, of my psychosis that are of such concern. And from a society point of view, I can understand that. And if I am proud of any achievement in my life, I would say I'm proud of the fact that I can weather those storms on my own, totally unaided, with no help from anybody. And in fact, I don't truly believe that other people can help. I think you have to do a lot of that hard work yourself, resisting impulses, holding down all kinds of violent, destructive, terrifying thoughts, and just letting them run through you. Holding yourself like an instrument that's been played in a way and just letting the wind blow through you and just letting it go through until it's all over, knowing then that it's safe again and you can relax a little bit and start to enjoy life a little bit. I remember the first time coming out of a really deep depression, realizing that I had beautiful toes, and I've got massive spades of toes, but it was just because after months and months and months, I could see beauty. For many people, coincidental things happen and they can accept it and move on. For me, they have far too great a significance. And also, for me, there are many significant things that have happened in my life where there is great coincidence. So it's hard to rule out that significance. It seems to be very strong in case of death. I had a really good childhood friend. We were very close. He was a little bit upset that I wasn't making any contact, and he'd lived a tough life, and now he was doing really well and studying and getting his act together. And I woke up at 4 a.m. and opened the door, and there was a cub fox sitting on the doorstep. And the cub went out into the field and he played with a bullock in the field, like playfully ran in front of this bullock and then out through a hedge. And I came in and I think, I've got to write to Cubby. I didn't know where he was at the time. I thought he was in London. So I sat down and I was looking out the window and writing to him in a really slow, peaceful letter at 4:30 a.m. telling him all about the cub fox at the door and things that were happened locally, very little, just some news. And then I put away the letter when it got to about 6 or 7 o'clock. I called down to his mother's house just down the road, just went down during the middle of the day, and I discovered he was gone to Indonesia. And I could see the priest arriving down the hill. I was just leaving and I passed the priest going up the hill and I just got this really strange feeling. So it turns out that Cubby had drowned in Indonesia at the time when that cub fox was standing on the doorstep. It's at 13 now, episodes. You know, sometimes when things are rising and I see things happen, like lots of coincidences happen. I mean, not just coincidence, but things really very synchronous, like things just happening on the moment, at the minute. Like I walk in the door and the person I've just mentioned is standing there to meet me and they're holding something that I've been thinking about and everything is falling completely into place. It's very difficult to try and hold myself in reality because the seduction of mania is just so powerful and so irresistible. When it does happen, next thing I know is I'm doing something out of order or saying something very inappropriate. And there's a hand on my shoulder, and it's often my wife saying, we've got to get you to hospital, because literally within hours, I can get into a very, very deep manic state. And to such a point that the hospital now has given me medication to keep at home, antipsychotic medication, just to take it immediately, even before arriving at the hospital, because they know minutes count, basically. When I say I have an episode, it really means that I'm in a psychotic state where there is something else controlling my life rather than the normal average reality. And in that state, I allow myself to be reachable. Sometimes it takes great effort, but I do allow myself to be helped, for people to force help on me, even though I may not want it. And the reason I respond so obediently in those cases is because of the times in episodes when things have happened where I think I am doing something great for the world. And then later I realise through somebody else's testimony or somebody interrupting me that I have been about to do some great harm. In recent years, I have developed better strategies to deal with the episodes, and that have meant that they have been shorter in duration, quicker action, also better antipsychotics that work for me a lot better. When I was in hospital in Germany in Ansbach, the diagnosis I got was that of cannabis psychosis. Smoking rope is crazy. It means that the psychosis that I was exhibiting was induced by the use of cannabis. Now, they had done really detailed tests on my head, plastic swimming cap on the head in the dark room, which I found was amazing. And as they were doing it, I knew they were going to recognise my brilliance in there. And that's why I was shocked when they gave me that diagnosis. It took 4 years to eventually leave the smoking dope and the need for it. But many other things changed with that. Lithium is considered as a balancer. That's something I take all of the time, whether it works or not. It may do some good, I don't know. I've had as many episodes with lithium as without lithium. But the big advantage for me in taking lithium, for years I didn't take remedies and fought with the hospital authorities about medicines. And when I decided to take the lithium, I get so much help from the hospital, particularly when I go back in and say, listen, I don't smoke, I don't drink, I don't take drugs, I don't overstress myself in the workplace, and I'm still having an episode. Why is this happening? They just answer very honestly, we don't know. So the episodes now haven't been as severe in recent years, but they are as sudden, because it's like I'm always close to that edge. And if something happens then that brings me to the edge, it can just be a couple of days, and then it's hours, like into the extreme mania. In much later episodes, I started to have stronger feelings about things happening. In one instance, I had a premonition about a really bad accident, just a sense that there is going to be a huge accident. And I rang a health professional that I was in contact with at the time, and I explained the situation. And I was told, this is not your doing. Whatever happens today, you're not responsible for it. There's a lot of people who are able to deal with that kind of information. I'm given lots of information by the universe or whatever, but I don't know how to process it. For me, it's an overload. So it's better for me not to be going there too much. But in this case, we were driving into Wexford. I looked in the rearview mirror and I saw this whole accident unfolding where there was three cars involved, but there was a people carrier that spun in the air on its nose and tumbled over the fence. And I kept remembering what I'd been told that morning, and I said, be really calm. I was the first person on the scene of the accident. Get out really slowly, walk over to the first car. You cannot deal with this. There's three cars. There could be lots of people. find one person and just play the whole thing down. And that's what I did. I got the front seat passenger out of the car that had turned on its roof over the fence, and he was the son of the driver. Other people were beginning to stop now and help with the other cars and the other passengers. And I came back and went back in through the passenger side, and it was quite obvious that that the driver was dead. So I decided that the best I could do was focus on the young man that I'd taken out of the front seat. And I took him a little bit away from his mother, and I sat with him on the ground, just holding him, sitting on the grass. And then lots and lots of people helped. Obviously, it was a big accident. The strange thing was that at the end, when all the services came in and when he was in good hands, I got up and I walked away and I stopped at one of the guards. I just said, do you need any details or that? And they were too busy and they didn't want, so my name wasn't taken or anything, which was quite strange, seeing as I was the witness to the whole event. And I was allowed to move out of the accident in a way. And I didn't get carried away with the event. I've been living here with mental illness since 1987, and many people come to see me in need of help. And I've never really been able to offer help. Normally I advise people to seek professional help. But there have been three occasions where I've known people and they've gone to seek help, you know, with serious mental illness, you know, or brewing. In those three cases, three young women went to hospital and weren't admitted. And there is a thing about being admitted to hospital, just being brought inside that door, immediately symptoms change. It's like you know you are in that safe place where you will be looked after. Maybe brutally, who knows, but you'll be looked after. In these three cases, they all, the night of going home from the hospital, alone with a bag of medication, committed suicide. The mental hospitals in Ireland are not accessible. I'm a veteran patient, so once my name is mentioned, there's no problem. I can come straight in. And once you're on the books, you're sorted. But getting on the books can be very difficult. And sometimes extreme things have to happen. And sometimes it's just too late. People don't want to move too quickly and put professional people in that into mental hospitals. If we had a stigma-free society, maybe the best thing in the world, when you're just not feeling well, is to be, listen, come with us. Come inside into a safe environment for a week or two. Let's see how things work out. I've made it. Like, I've made it this far. This is as far as my father and my uncle and lots of people made it in life, and they had very healthy lives. So really, I feel I've been very fortunate. I've never managed to do such great harm that it's resulted in me being made a criminal. I think if somebody's unfortunate enough to commit some kind of an act where they enter the criminal system early on, it's very hard to recover from that in terms of humiliation, in terms of your self-respect and confidence. And they all add to the difficulties of making full recoveries. Where I work, there was no knowledge of my mental health history when I had my first episode. The company was very accommodating. And not only that, but when I came back to work, there were no barriers put in my way for development as a design engineer. And I get great support still from my company, you know, I really do. I think also I have enormous support from my wife. Like, she's someone who understands me better than any medics, doctors, healers. She's the main spotter in my life. She will see things where other people won't see them, and she will even disagree with the medics and always turn out to be right. There are very few marriages that survive manic depression. In my last episode, I was fascinated with the story of bees and drawing bees. And I knew so little about bees. I was drawing them yellow and black like a wasp. I didn't even know that they were more kind of a black colour. I knew nothing about bees. So then she said to me, just before going back to work after that last episode, would you consider beekeeping? And since then, it's been a huge thing. And I've become a woodworker. I've become I've been making my hives. I've been preparing the area. I've become a planter of flowers and herbs, which I never had an interest in before. It's just transformed things in a beautiful way. Like, and it was ready to be transformed in that way, our small holding here. It was just ready for bees. And for me, for my mental health, they're with me every day. And I mean, they are an obsession, you know, but a very healthy one. and one that bring great reward. When I'm in mania, of course, I don't sleep. In earlier days, she couldn't bear the sound of snoring. And now she would find that snoring is one of the most comforting things, because it means that her husband is safe, that he's well, that he's sleeping tonight. He's not wandering. He's not going off there.